Recently, we saw the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, and we're going to talk right now with Dr. E.J. Hutchinson of Hillsdale College, who is in the classics department there. And he's written an article recently, for example, about the Reformation and liberal learning. Dr. Hutchinson, it's great to have you on the program. Thank you for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Sure. For Vocal Point, I'm Jerry Newcomb. All right, let's get right to it. What kind of impact did the Reformation have on education, especially higher learning?
To answer that, I think we need to go back to something that was very fundamental in the concerns of the Protestant reformers, which had to do with the Bible, the reading of the Bible and the availability of the Bible and the proper way of understanding it. So if we turn the clock back a little bit further, beginning with the Renaissance, we start to have more of a focus on recovering a historical understanding of the ancient world, and of texts in their proper context, in their proper historical context, and along with that comes a revival of the study of ancient languages, particularly Greek and Latin. And among the Protestant reformers, this becomes especially significant in the use to which they put it for the study of Scripture. And so you have a big emphasis on being able to read the Bible in the original languages in Greek and Hebrew, along with the traditions of commentary on it, and then along with that a desire to translate the Bible into the languages of the people from the original sources So into German, into French, into English, and so on, from the Greek and Hebrew originals, and then to teach it in such a way that it could be understood in terms of its original intent. Along with this larger availability of Scripture comes a rise in literacy, a rise in the desire for literacy. So you have a lot more people learning to read, particularly so that they can come to a greater understanding of Scripture. And so in the realm of higher education itself, you get whereas you had a pretty big focus in the Middle Ages on dialectic, on logic, and the main texts that were used for teaching were medieval texts. In universities, beginning in particularly in the 16th century and afterwards, you get more study of history, poetry, rhetoric, of texts, as I mentioned a minute ago, of texts in their original context, and that kind of thing.
So, in other words, there was a not only a resurgence of interest in the Scriptures per se, but then also of other classics from antiquity.
Yes, that's right. Because one of the desires that was pretty widely shared was again the desire to understand texts in the context in which they were written. So, you get the Bible coming out of the world of the ancient Near East, when we think of the Old Testament, and from a Greco-Roman context when we think of the New Testament, and so it becomes important to to look at the world in which the Bible was written, and so Greek and Roman texts are important for that. In addition, there was a pretty widely shared belief that that the Greek and Roman classics were useful to a large extent in teaching eloquence, in teaching ethics in certain respects, and teaching a good literary style and so on and so forth. So they were important for a variety of reasons, but I would suggest that one of the big reasons was to enable a kind of thicker understanding of historical context and the world out of which the Bible came and the world into which Christ was born and in which he lived and died and rose again.
Hmm. And it's interesting, too, when you mentioned the Bible being translated into the everyday language. So Luther, for example, translates the Bible into German. And as I understand it, he basically transformed the German language. I mean, it was kind of before Luther's translation of the Bible, German, the German language before it, and the German language after it. And Tyndale translated the Bible in English as much as he could before he was martyred for his efforts, unfortunately. But then some of the French followers of Calvin, I understand, did that with the French. And all those things helped revolutionize the languages in which they were translated into.
No, that's absolutely correct. Once you start to get scripture in the vernacular languages, and these kind of archetypal translations that, you know, set the agenda even for all of the ones that come after. So Luther's German Bible, Tyndale's in English. I mean, even, you know, a huge percentage of the authorized version or King James version of the Bible, which was the one that was, or one of the chief translations that was so influential for so long, you know, are just taken directly from Tyndale. And so even the way we talk now has some relation to these early translations of the Bible. So yeah, they certainly transformed ordinary speech and idiom forever afterwards.
Yeah. And it's interesting too. I mean, even some of the words that they were biblical concepts, but it was Tyndale who actually coined those words. I'm thinking, example, Passover, scapegoat. Mm-hmm. These came from the brain of William Tyndale. And then, of course, because they were immortalized in the King James Version about a century later, you know, they passed down to the rest of us. It's fascinating. But I understand that there are modern criticisms of the Reformation that, in effect, the whole movement was essentially anti-higher education or anti-liberal learning. And that's not necessarily correct, as you say in your article.
No, I don't think that's right. And I'm not sure exactly where this comes from. I mean, sometimes there seems to be an idea out there that that before the Reformation there was this kind of medieval synthesis, the sort of union of culture and religion and way of looking at the world in sort of high and exalted terms, that that the Reformation and then of the religious disputes that followed it sort of destroyed. But that's not really true. I mean, what you actually find historically with the in the countries that embraced the Reformation, you know, Switzerland, Germany, England, Scotland, and so on, what you actually find is a great increase in learning. And, you know, part of the reason for that is the Reformation starts as a university movement. Because of the emphasis that it tended to place on preaching, exposition, exhortation, and all the rest of it, there was a real need for an educated pastorate. And so if that was going to occur, you know, they had to have institutions in which to do it. And so academies, colleges, universities are incredibly crucial for carrying out the aims of the Reformation and lead to a really, really heavy stress being placed on the importance of education. So, I mean, to give one example, when, you know, so John Calvin is in Geneva, and then he's sort of ignominiously banished and sent away, and he goes to Strasbourg, and eventually they realize, hey, maybe that wasn't such a good idea, and we would like him to come back. And so they bring him back to Geneva, and one of the first things that he does is to draw up a set of ecclesiastical ordinances in consultation with the city magistrates. And one of the desires that is expressed in those ecclesiastical ordinances is that is that a school be established and open. Now, it took a while for this to actually occur, but this was the institution that became the University of Geneva eventually, which is still around. But the reason for its foundation and the kinds of things that should be taught are made explicit in the document. Mm-hmm. So things that we would consider, you know, liberal arts, languages, so a really rigorous kind of classical education. And, you know, they say that the two groups especially that need to participate in this are those who are going to be pastors and teachers of theology and those who are going to go into the government of the city, because they think that, you know, men aren't going to be able to fill those functions adequately if they haven't been properly trained. And even the teachers of theology aren't going to be able to do their job adequately unless they have first received a kind of broad and rich and deep and thorough education in all of the disciplines that are relevant to, you know, understanding and teaching the text of Scripture.
Yeah, and, you know, when you're saying all these things, I can't help but think of a plaque I've seen chiseled in stone right at one of the entrances of Harvard, and it says, you know, we who founded this school, you know, our desire was that knowing that one day our ministers will lie in the dust. I'm kind of paraphrasing here and then partly quoting, you know, we decided to, you know, train up further ministers of the gospel, knowing that this is going to happen rather than relying on them, you know, coming from England. I mean, that's the gist of what they're saying. Then think about this. The Puritans came and founded Boston in 1630. By 1636, they founded Harvard to train future ministers. And so there was this actually a very strong emphasis on the part of education, on the part of Protestants. I mean, it was Presbyterian elders that founded Princeton, and William and Mary founded to, you know, train future Anglican ministers. Yes, go ahead.
No, that's absolutely correct. And so you see the kind of downstream heritage of this in the United States, certainly in the foundation of colleges and universities, beginning in New England in the 17th century and you know, carrying on the 18th century, the 19th century. And you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the big reasons for that continues to be the desire for an educated pastorate. So even at an institution like Hillsdale, where I teach, in the 19th century, I forget what the percentage was, but an enormous percentage of students who graduated from here went into the Baptist ministry afterwards. And so, I mean, in a lot of respects, we owe the reformers this impulse for widespread education and what we see, you know, carrying on in the foundation of institutions in the United States. I mean, despite the fact that, you know, many of these by this point have sort of have wandered away from what they were originally founded to do. Nevertheless,
significantly so.
That's what provided that kind of original impulse for having all of these institutions of education.
Yeah, it reminds me of the old statement from Cotton Mather, one of the great Puritans. He said, "Religion begat prosperity, and the daughter hath consumed the mother." Well, we're basically out of time. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. E.J. Hutchinson from Hillsdale College. That's hillsdale.edu. Is that correct?
That's correct. And thank you for having me.
Sure. Thank you now. Bye-bye.